candid conversations that might just change how you look at the world. Let's bridge cultures, transcend borders, and build a global family of changemakers. Welcome to If by Chance.
Raised by a single mum in rent-controlled housing, Wayne Boatwright's financial situation got so tough that during his final year of school, he went for just 2 hours a day so he could work to support his family. And yet, he went on to have the life many Americans dream of, scaling the ladder of meritocracy to become an Ivy League educated attorney until things came crashing down.
I am the quintessential American meritocracy success story. So I was raised by a single mother who didn't graduate high school and had a half brother in rent control housing with government assistance. I studied okay in high school, not great. I knew I was smart, but I had other things to do. I was working from the time I was 15 and a half. So I basically was working throughout high school. My last year in high school, for example, I only went to school for 2 hours and had work study for the rest of the days to work because I needed to earn some money. I bought my family's first car, my family's first TV. I took that responsibility seriously as a young man. Thought I would go to school, but didn't start college till I was 21 and began again at the basis level, what's called a junior college here. It's only the first 2 years, and had to take a lot of remedial courses because so much time had gone by, and ultimately got my degree. I got a major in economics, a minor in international relations, and a minor in Spanish at Brigham Young University. I went there for 2 years and then went to Cornell Law School, which is one of our Ivy League law schools. We got a law degree from there and focused on business law, not the lawyers you see on TV, not criminal law, not courtroom drama. So that journey was a very steep progressive incline throughout my life, and one that I thought would always be my life, but it wasn't. I call it my fall with my crime, and so my life since then has been very, very different, not just by my time in prison, but how it's been since I've come back. I like to say I'm a returning citizen, but I say returning, not returned, because I don't feel I'll ever return, and that's kind of lonely. To be honest, most of my social network and community that I had made throughout my career, over 20 years in the Bay Area and in Silicon Valley, have not reconnected with me since I've come back.
How long ago was the crime?
The crime was in late 2011. I went to prison in 2012. Got out in 2019, so I've been home about 5 years. I was very severely injured as well, not that it matters. So I was lucky to have over a year between the crime and accepting a plea bargain, we call them, and then going to prison. I had a fractured pelvis, neck, back, ribs, had my concussion, had my foot reconstructed. I've got a plate and 8 screws in it. It doesn't matter, but I'm grateful I had that year to get physically fit. Because if you're not physically fit in prison, you know, you're either a predator or prey in prison, and you don't want to be seen as prey. And if you're physically weak, you're just at risk.
What led up to the crime?
I was an alcoholic at the time, to be honest. I had bad days and I drank a lot, right? But I was functional. The journey that I've been on and a path that I think is much more common than people seem to realize is that I had developed a number of defense mechanisms as a child, a very young child, so I don't have memories of them. I've just seen the consequences of them. And those defense mechanisms suited me well through most of my younger life, but they weren't suited for the challenges I faced as an adult and as a husband and as a parent and as a son of a very sick family. So my mom had falling on some stairs and fractured her hip. She was on hospice. And so I was driving down to LA to help her and my special needs brother out as, you know, to get them out of their apartment into assisted living, a place that would take both of them, not just her, while also trying to deal with her medical conditions. And being better, faster, stronger, and having an intense sense of pride, that was the way I would say it to myself. I have to be better, faster, stronger. I hid and didn't recognize, because I had shut off most of my emotional self, the challenges I was going through. And so my coping mechanism was more and more alcohol. And that's what led to my crime. I actually had admitted my mother and brother into their assisted living facility. And the day of my crime, I was in LA and thought drinking Red Bull Vodkas was smart. Well, I cleaned out their apartment after they had moved out, and then decided I could drive back to San Francisco inebriated and continue to drink on the drive, actually. I don't remember the crime / accident per se, but by the time I was so drunk, I was not only blacked out, but I was going the wrong way on a freeway and had a head-on collision, which took a life and injured three others. But I don't have a recollection of most of that drive, let alone the crash itself. And I could go into much more detail about that if you like, the challenges that I was facing. But in essence, it was, I had to be better, faster, stronger, and that engendered a sense of pride, which wasn't real pride. It was a defense mechanism against feeling worthless, to be honest. And that was because of the childhood that I had. And it's not an attempt to blame my single parent mother. It's merely to acknowledge it was a very difficult life that I was raised in, and the defense mechanisms I developed to protect myself as a child weren't well suited for me as an adult. And I saw that exact same pattern with every single person I interacted with in prison. Heartbreaking stories. And I think not properly addressed. I think many times we treat symptoms instead of root causes. Addiction, violence, sexual abuse, all of these things, a need for money and self-aggrandizement, all of these things are defense mechanisms. They're not root causes. They're coping mechanisms to deal with an underlying challenge. And if you can't face whatever that underlying trauma is, so an example of how I would characterize things, trauma is not the event. So if a woman is raped, the rape, physical rape is not the trauma. The trauma is how she responds to that rape. And many people mischaracterize that. So they try to help her deal with the rape itself. It's like, no, you have to help her deal with how she's responding to it. And if you don't do that, then she will find a coping mechanism to face that. Now, that coping mechanism may be she hates all men and decides because I'm lesbian. An extreme case, right? But she will find a coping mechanism. And that coping mechanism can often be unhealthy. It might be addiction. It might be drug use. It might be bitterness. That's the way I would characterize most of the mental ills and maladaptions that we see in society. I think they're being misdiagnosed because we are treating symptoms. You know, you're a sex addict. Like, who cares? That's the coping mechanism. What drove them to want to think they needed to use sex as a coping mechanism? That's the only way you'll solve this or deal with your addiction. And so I feel comfortable that I've dealt with my alcoholism. I've been back 5 years. I've worked in a myriad of environments with open bars and exposed to alcohol on a regular basis. I'm not bothered by it. I'm not tempted by it. I don't feel like I have what I like to call the trigger that had me use that coping mechanism anymore. I feel like I've dismantled that through my journey. And yes, that journey included, I know you've had some mental health professionals on. I saw the one about, the difference between anxiety and things like that recently. And yes, I think mental health professionals can be very helpful if they help you deal with root causes and not symptoms. And unfortunately, I think the vast majority of mental health professionals can't get beyond the coping mechanisms you've developed to actually get to the root causes. And so they're not really helping very much, in my opinion. My opinions have become, I would characterize myself as a much harder man than I used to be. Not cruel, I don't think, but hard. So I would say something like that openly to you. It's not something I would have ever said before. I would have tried to couch it in more generous terms. but I got to call it like I see it. I feel the same way about our education system, which is failing, our criminal justice system, which is failing. Literally every single institution in the United States that is at risk right now, even our political institutions.
Can I ask you, how long were you in prison before you started to see similarities between yourselves and the others you were surrounded by?
Sooner than you probably think, but not that quick, if that helps at all. I was in, so you go through a three-level prison process. You go to county jail after you've been sentenced. Then you go to a reception area, which then assigns you to a particular prison. And that particular prison, in my case, was San Quentin, which is based in Marin County, about half an hour north of San Francisco, for example. And San Quentin is a very unique prison in many ways. It's a very old prison. It was built in the 1850s. It's a very famous prison. California's death row is in San Quentin, for example. So it houses a lot of famous inmates. But it's also unique in the sense that it's analogous to the most innovative and creative prison in the U.S. system. And I say that because I was the managing editor of the San Quentin News and wrote a heck of a lot of articles. And as the managing editor, oversaw the creation of hundreds, if not thousands, of articles in the times I was there about the criminal justice system in the United States mainly, but also globally, and what goes on at San Quentin. San Quentin has more volunteer groups than I bet the other 30 prisons in California combined that come in and offer programs. And so those different volunteer groups I would attend, and they're volunteer on both sides, the people who are the presenters or hosts, as well as the inmates who decide to take them. And I would say well over half of the inmates do not participate in these different programs, which could be AA or NA, but also nonviolent communications, restorative justice, victim offender dialogue, guiding rage into peace, a myriad of other ones that exist, many of them only in San Quentin, even though they are trying to expand to other prisons. So I was very active, both as a member and as a reporter / managing editor for the San Quentin News, covering those different organizations. And so my insights came from that. For me, in essence, the first 6 months were spent in survival mode. I had to establish my credibility and some level of safety and continuity. What really drove me to the deep, I like to say I burned down my psychic delusion house that I had built up over my lifetime, built with my belief, my faith, my education, my personal experience, my cultural community and environment. All of those things built that psychic delusion house. And what burned it down wasn't just my crime and my alcoholism and taking a life. It was the fact that less than 6 months into my sentence, the mother of my two children told me she wanted a divorce. And that was like the last thread of my tapestry, or the last safe room in my psychic delusion house, and it was burned down as well. And so I realized I had a lot of work to do, and that I decided I was going to rebuild that psychic delusion house as an adult, not as a follower of a faith, not as a student, as a sovereign individual. So I spent a lot of time and did a lot of work, most of it in reading and personal development, not the groups that I mentioned, but the groups were an important component and helped me start to recognize all the other men who were on, who had similar blind spots, I like to call them. They just manifested themselves in different ways for them than they did for me in many cases. And most of those ways led to crime, to be honest.
How do you go about building credibility in jail?
There are a number of different ways that are used. As an educated, older, adult, white male, I chose a somewhat unique path. Many of the men who are of my station would buy credibility or buy loyalty. I call them ATM machines. So they would give people things to be kept safe and to have acknowledgement. I found that the best way to do that is to establish a mutual respect. And so that's to be of use to the community, but also to work on a process of quid pro quo trading things with one another, being open to that. Never giving things, though. I think too many people miss that. So they think just giving things away is like that. You're just an ATM machine to them. You know, they're going to come at trying to make a withdrawal, and more of them will come because you're an ATM machine. You're never going to have peace, and you're never going to have enough money. But if you've earned their respect by being of use to the community and by trading, then you're considered a member of the community, and they'll allow you to be at peace at a much greater level. Having said that, in prison, you're at a state of hypervigilance that never really goes away. You never sleep a normal night. It took me over 2 years after I came home to sleep at night. The guards do regular rounds, and they jingle their keys at night when they go around the dorm of 200 men. And they jingle the keys not to be irritating. They jingle the keys to warn you they're coming so you can stop doing anything you shouldn't be doing for them to see. You can imagine that regular round and stuff, the lights, the sounds that people make in a dorm of 200 men with double bunks is not a very peaceful environment. And hypervigilance is also one of status seeking and violence that exists in the California prison system, in many ways different than other prisons in the U.S.
Did you make any friends?
Of course. Yeah, I made a number of friends and stay in touch with them regularly. I think, you know, I deal with a lot of Americans who are very big on virtue signaling their beliefs in racial equality. And I simply ask the white ones, well, how many black friends do you have on Facebook or Instagram? Because I've got 150. And I haven't met a single white person who has that many. Are they really my friends? Of course not. You know? But they trust me and they respect me and they want to connect with me. And they're curious about my life because they knew me and they knew I was a real person in prison and I treated them with respect. And so, of course, they want to connect with me on Facebook. And I want them to. I want them to see how I interact with my children on Facebook and the posts that I make and the pride that I have in my kids and the photos that I take of the places I've been with them and visiting, because I want to be a role model for a lot of these guys. And I have to be very careful about that because most of them are minorities and they've been told what to do by the white man for too long for a white person to tell them anything. But I can be a good role model, at the very least. Not telling them what to do, just showing them what I do and letting them make a decision. And so I work very hard at that.
Some people might be fearful about staying connected to those types yeah. of people.
There are a lot of people who are fearful. Yeah, you're right.
Why aren't you?
I'm a hard man. Close to a third of the inmates in the California system are in a form of protective custody. Some of them are pedophiles. Some of them are gang members who have been injured while in prison and they're there for safety. But a lot of them are just inmates who feel they can't safely navigate what's called the main line. And so they ask for protection. So most of the guys like me are in protective custody in the California system. I chose not to do that because protective custody doesn't give you access to all of the nonprofit groups and volunteer groups that I mentioned. And I needed to have access to those. I needed to find out why I thought it was okay to become an alcoholic and so prideful that I could be so drunk. I thought I could drive and take a life. I had to find out why. And I knew the best shot for me to do that was to participate in groups like AA and NA and the other ones that I've mentioned. Now, I could only do that on the main line, so I stayed on the main line.
So protective custody operates whilst you're in jail, not afterwards?
Segregated.
Yeah, okay.
Segregated yards.
And those nonprofit groups that you mentioned, they sound like they are treating symptoms. They don't really sound like creative outlets.
True. The vast majority of them are treating symptoms, but that's a start, right? That's a start. And you have to start somewhere. Many of these guys literally are so disconnected from their internal true self, they don't even realize they've committed a crime. And so they need that. They need to start somewhere. And so I think that's fine. Some of them are much more sophisticated than that. For example, at Vogue that I went to, which is the Victim Offender Dialogue Group, which culminates in a panel with victims who have lost somebody to a criminal, a family member that has been murdered. And so to prepare for that, you need to go through a long, many modules and processes. And many of those modules deal with acknowledging your crime, accepting responsibility for it, recognizing the actual impact it had, not just on your victim, but on your victim's family and community and the community in general, on yourself, on your family. But it also asks you to look at how you were a victim and to understand what happened to you as almost always as a young child. And so the men I saw were sexually abused, emotionally abused, violent, extreme violence. And everybody will think it'll be from their, very few of them had a stable household. None of the ones that I know were in a two-parent household, or if it was two parents, it was a cycle of a number of different fathers with the same mother. So most of their, what are called brothers and sisters, were actually half brothers and sisters, which creates a very different dynamic of competition in the home environment than you might appreciate if you don't have any step siblings or half brothers and sisters to appreciate it. And so I heard all of their stories, how their mother would whip them with electrical cords, how a coach would invite them to a basketball game and then sexually abuse them and buy them things because they were poor. How a father would put razor blades in soapy dishwater and force the mother to do the dishes as punishment, or to kill a pet as punishment. Horrific, traumatic experiences. Not to justify what they did as adults, but if you want to understand why they did it, you have to go that far back. And so some of these groups do that, but not very many.
Do you know how any of the others that you were in prison with, how they're doing now?
Sadly, it's more mixed than I like to admit. A number of them are doing very well. Only two of the, say, 20 guys that have gotten out who work with me at the San Quentin News, however, have jobs in what I call the private sector. Virtually all of them are working at nonprofits, which I consider to be not a private sector, closer to a government job in many ways. I know one that has, a number of them got married, not always a good sign, because not just for them, but the women who are looking for them can sometimes be unhealthy. But some have been healthy and they pay taxes and they buy houses and they're doing great and have babies. I love it. I'm very happy for them. But I also know a guy who went back to his addiction and a guy who, and it's interesting that the ones I've seen commit crimes literally commit the same crime that they went to prison for. One stabbed his girlfriend because he was in the Navy and away on deployment and she got pregnant by another man. So he stabbed and killed her and her baby. And he did it again with his new wife after he's been home because she divorced him and he couldn't handle it. So don't get me wrong. I wouldn't contend they've all done well, but the majority of them have moved into fruitful lives. I wish more of them were in the private sector than in the nonprofit sector. I think that can make them kind of crazy because it's like a religion, not a job in many ways. But that's my opinion. I know many people just believe in it very strongly and don't consider it a religion. I think it fills a religious size hole in people's life. And whether they're Greenpeace or criminal justice reform, or I think it's filling a religious size hole. And they treat it like a religion. So you can be an apostate, and you can be cast out, and you better believe or you're in trouble. And I think a lot of these guys have fallen into that. So I'm a big data guy. I love technology and I love research and facts. I'm the guy who reads the footnotes in articles and books and tend to gain more value from the footnotes than from the main articles, in my opinion. So I like to characterize the world we live in now as one where a social microscope has been created via social media delivered by smartphone, where we can see individual lives and hear about individual lives in amazing detail and in real time. But we also have a digital telescope, because big data sets and complexity theory and other things are allowing us to put mathematical formula and get very good probabilities against large groups. Not predicting individuals. Again, it's big data. It's a telescope, not a microscope. But for example, there's something called an ACE score, which is Adverse Childhood Experience score. And so they go through about 20 different things. And the higher your score, the more likely you are to be maladapted. And those could be unstable living environment, parents didn't work, divorce, violence. You can imagine what those adverse child experiences can be. And there's a direct correlation. The higher your ACE score, the more likely you are to be a murderer, the more likely you are to be in prison. It's what is. And that is back to that childhood experience. But again, they tend to treat symptoms, not root causal. They recognize the ACE score and that it creates a very high probability of you being at risk, but they may not help you find out. They may help you get more in touch with your emotional self. I'm not saying that, but they may not help you find out why you developed the defense mechanism to shut off your emotional self in the first place. And until you can get there, I think you're still at risk, to be honest, of finding a different coping mechanism, maybe not a criminal one, but it's still a coping mechanism rather than facing the challenge itself and dealing with it.
When you look at yourself now versus before the time of the crime / accident, is it clear to you how you view the world differently?
Yes. It's interesting. I just made a realization, a number of different realizations in the last couple of months. I'm currently seeing a psychologist, so I do believe in mental health. If you can find somebody who's doing their job, I think you need a somebody who's not connected to you to talk with. It could be a small group environment as well. I think that's why AA is as successful as it is for many people. It provides them that opportunity to have sounding boards and to be honest and frank and vulnerable with people. The way I like to characterize a lot of my actions is I'm driving my car and I'm afraid to make a left-hand turn. So I make three right-hand turns to get to the direction I want to go. But I've told myself it's impossible to make a left-hand turn. In fact, I may not even recognize a left-hand turn is an option. I may think the only way is those three right-hand turns, which is much less efficient and doesn't get me exactly to where I want to go. And so learning to recognize my blind spot, that I can make a left-hand turn, overcoming the anxiety I may have about that, is part of my journey of self-improvement. That's what I need. I'm seeking to constantly improve myself and be a better person than I was before. And in many ways, that's different than I expected. One of the realizations I came through just the last couple months was that if the old me saw the life I had right now, I would be on suicide watch. I was so caught up in my status and in my education and in my elite educated professional class membership. And I don't have that anymore. And it's not that I don't miss that experience. I'd say about 10% of my friends have stayed in contact with me. And because they are elite and educated and professional, I can have much more interesting conversations with them than I can with my fellow former inmates at prison. I may communicate with those guys from inside, but I don't necessarily enjoy the conversations nearly as much as I would with somebody who is a lawyer or a business professional or a business owner. I enjoy those conversations more.
What brings you the enjoyment? Is it that's where you want to belong?
It was. And so that's why I say suicide watch of my prior self. I don't feel that way now. I feel fine. The greatest solace for me, the greatest comfort is to see how amazing my two children have turned into young adults. My son turned 20 in March this month, and my daughter turned 18 in February last month. And when I went to prison, they were 6 and 8 years old. And I was in prison for well over 6 years. And remember, the year before I went to prison, I was physically incapacitated for much of that time. I was in a hospital for 90 days. I was in a wheelchair, walker, crutches. I was on opioids, mega doses of morphine to get through that time. And so I was checked out in many ways. And so I missed much of their childhood and their development. I destroyed two families with my crime. I destroyed my victim's family by taking her life, but I also destroyed my family. And the consequences of that are permanent. I think when I say how you respond to the trauma is the issue, how you respond to the traumatic act is the issue. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a scar there. There's always going to be a scar. I just hope it stops being an open wound and that you can have a successful life afterwards. And so my kids were scarred by me, by my experiences. There was a period while I was in prison where my son wouldn't visit me for 18 months because his friends at school found out I was a prisoner. You know, I was a felon, and they made fun of him. And he was ashamed. And he was angry. He was hurt. But he was very young. And he thought he was just angry. He didn't realize the other emotions, which would better characterize what he was going through. And so he didn't know the tools to deal with that. But luckily, his mother, she had committed to bring the children to visit me while I was in prison. In fact, I had moved. I'd used every lever I could before I went to prison to make sure when I was classified to go to a prison, I would go to the San Quentin prison. Not because of the groups that were there. That was just a lucky result. It was because it was the closest prison to my family. I wanted my children to visit me. I realized that being with them was essential for me to have any sense of continuity and not lose them completely. And having them visit me and share a meal or play a game of Uno or a game of Monopoly and tell stories in that visiting room for a couple hours every couple months was essential for me to maintain a relationship with them, and was only possible with the good grace of my ex, their mother, who kept that commitment. And I will always be grateful to her for that. So for me, the happiness I have is seeing how successful my children are, how they've overcome their challenges. My son is spending this semester in Washington, D.C. on a satellite campus of his university. And he works 3 days a week, and he goes to school the other days, but he's been to the White House 3 times in the past 2 months. He has a retired congressman that's one of his instructors. He has a retired CIA agent that's another one of his instructors. He had a class where 2 sitting congressmen and 2 of their chief of staffs came and taught them. So he's exposed to these wonderful opportunities, and he's fully engaged in that as a student, learning as much as he can. And I deeply admire his work ethic and his desire. And he's a straight-A student, just as his sister is a straight-A student as a senior in high school. And his sister is captain of the varsity golf team, and she's done that for 2 years. And I'm more proud of the fact that her teammates gave her a Mother Duck Award than I am about the fact that she was elected vice president of her class, or that she's a straight-A student, because that shows how much she cares about her fellow teammates and how much they'd appreciate and admire her, that she's been a captain there for 2 years. And so their leadership and their development and their intelligence and curiosity are all that I could have ever dreamed of and would have given anything for. And it's not guaranteed by any sense of financial well-being. I know a lot of friends of mine who are well off, whose kids are complete backs to kisses. It's not that. So I'm very grateful for that. My prior life, the status would have been very important to me. Now I just miss being able to talk with people who can understand what I'm talking about, who can understand the chandelier that I'm trying to light up. Most of the guys in prison can't get beyond a light bulb, either because of their educational level, or their intelligence, or both.
Can you outline the structure of this chandelier?
Not in the time we have. I've written a lot about it. I'll give you a quick example of what I mean. If anybody has heard of a famous Canadian philosopher and intellectual, his name was Marshall McLuhan. And Marshall McLuhan was famous for saying the medium is the message, not the content of the medium. His explanation is a template that explains our digital age right now. The medium of digital technology is what is changing us, not what we see on the digital technology. It's changing us and getting us caught in what I like to call empathy traps, driven by the social microscope of social media delivered by smartphone. And those empathy traps have destroyed our ability to make rational decisions as a culture. An example of what that would be, that in the United States during COVID, we wouldn't allow people to have memorial services for the risk of catching COVID, but we thought it was okay to allow mass demonstrations as part of the BLM movement, the digital microscope of our new digital technology. We were not allowed to be disinterested anymore. We're all connected. And there's good things about that. It makes us care about our environment, for example. But there are bad things about that as well. For example, if only lived experience can determine insight into a particular problem, then we lose any ability to have a rational decision. If you've been in a car accident, you might want to drive a tank next time to make sure you're not in a car accident. That's not rational, but that's your lived experience. And I think I see a lot of overweighting of lived experience in our current era, especially in the United States, but I imagine it's everywhere, to be honest.
If I just take the counter to that.
Sure.
If we go back to when we weren't in a digital age and there were newspapers and people were controlling the press, why is that not the same as what we're experiencing now? It's just that people had more space between the times that they were consuming the information.
I would contend that time had different problems. For example, we still had empirical-based science that was accepted, something that is not generally accepted anymore, in my opinion. So the institutions were stronger. And the fact that there may have been a small group of people driving mass media, people still had space to make individual choices. Today, there is no space to make an individual choice. You instantly have to decide you are with us or you're against us. And if you don't, you risk being ostracized, ghosted. And so you don't have time to make a decision. You're going to make that decision instantaneously. And by any stretch of imagination, an instantaneous decision is a greater risk than a decision you make with consideration and time and hopefully information. The best person who's described this, I'm a big reader, and I write about this a lot. There's an English professor named David Deutsch, and David Deutsch believes in the concept of constructor theory. He basically thinks that criticism is the central component, not the result. So, for example, under his theory, the advantage of a democracy is not who you elect. The advantage of a democracy is who you can unelect by throwing them out of office. It's the inverse of what people think. He would also contend that we don't gain insight by observation, that observation merely allow us to prove the hypotheses that somebody has postulated by their creativity, and that we need criticism in order to do that. Unfortunately, our current world, criticism is not allowed. Again, look at the people who were concerned about the vaccine or the lockdowns with COVID, who have been ostracized, even if they were professionals and had expert opinions that have since been proven true. And yet their careers and their lives have been ruined because they didn't instantly agree with the knee-jerk assessment of people who are afraid. That empathy trap is about fear as much as it is about empathy. And people are driven by fear more often than they are by reasoned analysis and decision-making, I believe. And that's a real problem in our culture. And I'm fearful of where our culture will end up because of it.
With that, let's segue to AI. What's your view on AI and what do you think its impact might be on society?
I've written about it. I've studied it. I've taken a class from Vanderbilt University on what's called prompt engineering, because the most popular form of AI right now is called an LLM, or a large language model. And large language models are amazingly sophisticated data sets that do pattern recognition, and it recognizes the pattern based on what prompt you give it. So if you don't know how to ask it a question, you're not going to get a useful answer. So you have to learn. So this is another example of how our society has changed. It used to be about memory recall, so learning things and being able to recall that. And now critical thinking is really about asking the right question. Information has become frictionless, limitless, and free. So having information is almost irrelevant. It's how you can access the information. Again, the prompt, the question, the critical thinking that's important. AI misconstrued what AI does. We recently had one of the driverless self-driving cars in San Francisco was burned. And many people are afraid that self-driving cars can cause accidents. That is a digital social microscope mindset, not a digital telescope big data set mindset. A big data set mindset has proven again and again that AI will dramatically improve virtually any industry. And I've done studies on healthcare, the judicial system, education, self-driving cars, the insurance industry. It doesn't matter. All of them will be improved by AI, not by improving the top end that much. Recognizing cancer. I'll give you an example that's in a wonderful book called Noise, written by Cass Sunstein and a number of other authors. Template to understand where AI is going, and the way I would contend is the best expression of the potential for AI and why I'm not afraid of it. Let's say that AI can recognize cancer from the data sets that it has 72% of the time, and the best doctor can do it 70% of the time. I don't need AI for the best doctor. I need AI for the doctors who are recognizing it at 30 to 50% of the time. If I can get that bottom, if I can raise the floor, that's the dramatic improvement in society, not raising the ceiling. And people focus on the ceiling. So if I use the self-driving car as an example, I'm not worried about the best drivers out there. It's the worst drivers. It's the senior citizens who shouldn't be driving anymore. It's the ones who are inebriated or somehow some other ways impaired who are trying to drive cars. I want to raise the floor. That's where AI is going to help the most. It will dramatically reduce accidents, not because it's better than the best driver. It's because it's that much better to get these bad drivers off the road, bad doctors out of the hospital, bad lawyers out of the legal profession, bad judges out of the courts. That's how AI is going to help, raising the floor. And it does it by reducing what's called noise. Noise is the scatter of decisions that can be made. And noise can be within a person or within a group of people. So you as an individual, again, the digital telescope of big data sets is giving us a lot of clarity about these things. They've proven that judges in the United States handing out criminal convictions hand out a more harsh conviction the day after their team loses in a sporting event. That's insane. No judge would admit that. No judge would think that of themselves. But the big data sets show us that. AI can reduce the noise, help that judge not be harsher. Other judges hand out harsher sentences at the end of the day because they're hungry. So if you don't have them in the morning, you're at risk. Other judges hand out harsher sentences only to a particular group that they may not like. And in the United States, that's expressed itself, sadly enough, mostly with our African-American community. African-Americans tend to have a harsher sentence given the same fact pattern of about 10%, 10 to 20% than Caucasians. That's unacceptable. They shouldn't have a harsher sentence because of their race. AI can reduce that risk, remove that risk. That's how it's used. I'm not worried about making everybody better. I'm worried about raising the floor by reducing the noise. And I think people's fear of the bias of AI is that empathy trap trigger mindset. They're afraid of something that they don't need to be afraid of. We're not going to be made into paperclips by AI. AI is not going to destroy us. Its benefit is to reduce noise. I'm not going to look at it to change other things. If you're afraid of it changing other things, then we should design AIs that doesn't change the way we act. Let's, in a general sense, let's have AI just reduce the variability in our decision making. In the insurance industry, they found that there's a range of 40% in the insurance premiums charged, even though it's the same fact pattern. It's insane how inefficient we are, and we just don't know about it. And we've only learned about it because of machine learning and big data sets driven by complexity theory and the advent of our digital technologies. We've only discovered these things in the last 10 years, and we're not taking advantage of them yet. So I love AI. I can't wait for it to come because I wanted to get rid of the bad judges, the bad drivers, the bad doctors, the bad lawyers, the bad teachers. And unfortunately, people don't want to admit they're bad. I'm sorry. The numbers don't lie. That's another great book. Vaclav Smil, who's a Czech immigrant to Canada and a professor at the University of Toronto, wrote a book titled The Numbers Don't Lie. Amazing at explaining how these big data sets can be used. Unfortunately, many people only look at one, and you have to do comparisons or you'll never understand it. An example of a comparison, if you want to worry about global warming, which I do, would be that if you compare the amount of carbon or CO2 that we've put in the atmosphere, we have put as much carbon in the atmosphere since 2000 as we did in the history of humanity before 2000. So people don't realize how it's accelerating right now. So many people will be calm about it and say, hey, it's no big deal. It's like, well, because you're looking at the whole spectrum, but if you were to divide that and have a denominator and a numerator, you'd realize just how quickly we're accelerating the CO2 we're putting in our atmosphere and what it does to the risk of global warming that represents. The fact that over 95% of all large mammals on Earth are either humans, their pets, or their food source. You need to have that comparison between wild. You say, well, there are reserves for elephants and lions and all that stuff. But when you realize it's well over 95% are foods, pets, and us, then you have an idea of the scope of how we've changed this world. So those are things that big data sets can give us.
What do you think we should be focusing on over the next 10 years?
I think for me, and I imagine would be useful for other people, is this ability to change from a reactive mindset into what's called a proactive mindset. Probabilities can help us to be proactive, to find out if somebody has a high ACE score, adverse childhood experiences, that they've had so many of them, that they're at risk of being an addict, for example. So maybe we could start that old adage, a pinch of prevention is better than a pound of cure, right? That's what proactive means. And I think we need to have the mindset of becoming proactive. And we can do that if we leverage these new technologies in healthier ways than we are right now. We have to learn to get back to some form of rationality from the emotion trap and empathy triggers we're stuck in, where we're making instantaneous decisions. And if we're going to make an instantaneous decision, at least learn how to ask the question right and use these large data sets provided by these LLMs to try to make an informed decision rather than just making it based on some YouTube or TikTok video you saw for 5 minutes.
You spoke earlier during our conversation about the volunteer groups within prison and how after people left prison, they started working with nonprofits, which in your view was a way for them to fill their life, fill their world, and give them a purpose.
Yes.
And we've spoken a lot about you know, what has gone wrong in these people's lives and in lives in general. Can we focus a little bit now on what people can do to fill their lives, to find something that might bring them a bit of joy and hopefully stop them from, you know, making choices that they'll regret later?
Yes, and we can. And a number of these groups are much more successful at that than I may have portrayed it when we talk about symptoms versus root causes, for example. One of them was started by inmates by what were called juvenile adults, which means that they might have been at 15 years old, but they were sentenced as if they were an adult and went to an adult prison. And they created their own group, and they've really worked hard to learn to face both the actions they've done and develop the tools they need to be contributing members of society. And they've been very successful with that because they trust themselves. It's the bootstrap mindset. They're not being told what to do. They've decided as a group, even if they may be 40 or 50 years old now, they might have gone to prison when they were 16, for example. And I think what I've found, and what I think many of these men do, is the advantage of some of the groups that they belong to is it creates a community that can support them through their challenges. Whether that community is driven by religion, and that religion could be Buddhism or meditation, which is very big in San Quentin, or Christianity, or the Islamic faith. Muslims are a very large segment of the African American, a significant segment of the African American community in the prison system. Whether they be Shia or Sunni, they do both of them. But those groups are very helpful for these guys to have some structure in their lives. AA is a very helpful group. NA is a very helpful group. GRIP, Guiding Rage into Peace, is a very helpful group for a lot of these guys who stay involved in these groups, usually as volunteer or paid facilitators after they get out to teach other groups. One of them is a group called Man to Man. And I've been on the board of Man to Man since I got out of prison. And man-to-man teaches fatherhood tools and principles to incarcerated men and youth, whether it's at a junior college, a college, people in county jail or people in state prison. There are two classes that are being taught right now in San Quentin by the founder of this group. Stewart is an African-American man, a former Marine, Presbyterian minister who has been a single father of two children himself. And so he's a wonderful both example and teacher to help men who desire to become better fathers develop the tools they need to do that. Tools of impulse control and nonviolent communications and setting boundaries in healthy ways. Many of the other things that these men neither had in their lives and don't may not even recognize they're missing, but that they need if they want to become the fathers that they can be. And those types of groups can start off as a formal, say, 6 month of coursework, but then they can have help groups that continue after that, where they'll do Zoom chats and meet once a month and discuss where they're at and what's going on. And so that format is very healthy, very effective, and one that I'm so grateful for many groups. I participate in two of them. I participate in three different regular groups like that. Right now, one a business group, one a church group, and then one a lifer group, or people who've been paroled after they spent their life in prison, because I think they're very helpful for me, and I like to be able to, again, have different sounding boards where I can hear what's going on in other people's lives and share what's going on in mine, and maybe recognize patterns in their lives that are occurring in my life that I need to watch out for. So I think that format of small group regular meetings is very important. And I don't care what organization it is. Again, it could be business, it could be religion, it could be criminal justice related or nonprofit related. But I find that to be a very effective tool for people. It helps them see their blind spots and be vulnerable and be open to change. And that's very good and very effective. And I'm so proud of the guys that I've gone to prison with I had one guy call me up and he had never paid taxes before. And he wanted help to fill out his tax return. Do you know how proud I am of that guy? And then he told me he wanted to buy his own house. And he wanted to know how to do it and how to increase his credit score. Do you know how proud I am of him that he wants to better his life? But he had no idea of these things, right? And I do, so I can help him with that. And he trusts me enough to be vulnerable with me to ask that question. Because unfortunately, many of these guys are taken advantage of by banks and by professionals because they don't understand these things. And by credit card companies, they're taken advantage of by car companies. A lot of these guys go out and buy new cars, the dumbest thing they could ever do. But they're convinced by our commercial culture and brainwashed by mass media that they have to have a brand new car. They can't be happy. That's not a way to invest in your retirement, invest in your kids, invest in your education, travel, for heaven's sakes, not a new car, if you ask my opinion. And I think if they hear stories of people who do those things, you recently had a podcast about world education and taking children and traveling. That's a great example, I think, of the potential that people could have to have their life be fulfilled, not with buying things as our commercial free market economy demands of them, but by having valuable experiences and sharing those experiences with others, whether it be your children or a group.
If I was to meet someone tomorrow who told me they'd been in prison, what advice would you give me?
Be willing to look them in the eye when you talk to them. You don't have to treat them like a burn victim that has scars on their face so that, and pretend like you don't see it by looking away and averting your gaze. And people do that. Physically will avert their gaze when they find out you've been in prison. They don't do it consciously. Just stay calm, look them in the eye. And you have to, the way I like to characterize it and the way I would recommend people deal with meeting the formerly incarcerated, again, I like to say returning citizen because I think citizenship is important. You serve sentence because you violated your citizenship in many ways. And so if you've served sentence and return, you should be able to return to full citizenship, in my opinion. One of the ways to do that is to recognize that a life happens for you. A life doesn't happen to you. Too often people think life happened to them as if they're a victim. No, life happened for you. There was something you were supposed to learn. And I'm not saying you wanted to learn it. And I'm not saying it's good that you had to learn it. But that's how you find out who you really are when you face those challenges. You think you know who you are in your comfortable life? Face a challenge. You know, live in Israel or Palestine or Ukraine right now. You'll find out who you really are in ways Americans and us comfortable people cannot understand. People who've gone to prison have found out who they really are in many ways. So treat them as somebody who's learned something. And so if you can be open to letting them share about that, you might be surprised what they'll tell you. Don't ignore it, but also don't make it the center of the conversation. I'm not saying that. But take advantage of an opportunity if possible to let them show you what they've learned. That's the best thing you could do.
What do you think being a returned citizen would look like for you?
It's very important for me to be of use. I've taken so much. Not just from my victim and her family and my family. I've taken so much from our communities, from our country. I could never repay that. But I do what I can. I'm on the board of Man to Man. I was a regular volunteer at the San Quentin News after I got out of prison. I was the web manager for 4 years for the online website. If people are curious about restorative justice or the efforts that can be done to reduce recidivism, it's called, to help these guys learn about themselves and stay out of prison, the San Quentin News is a great resource. It publishes about 60 articles a month about everything that happens in prison, the good, the bad, the ugly. And it's a great opportunity to find out what's really happening, not to be brainwashed by either side trying to convince you that we don't need prisons or trying to convince you these guys have to stay in prison until they're 85. It's insane. I knew a guy who was sentenced to 20 years to life and after 20 years, the parole board said he was suitable, so he was going to go home. And the governor revoked his parole, and he ended up serving 38 years for his crime. And I don't mention the crime. I'm trying to diminish the crime. But I'm confident that 20 years was enough for this. If public safety is your goal, 20 years was enough. If punishment is your goal, then leave him in forever. But if you claim it's public safety, then honor that claim by giving these guys a chance to get out and not keeping them in much longer than the sentence demands. Some of them have to stay in. I'm not saying that. Some of them are not able to face their crimes and should be held accountable because they're a risk to public safety. I'm not saying to increase public safety. I think we could reduce the prison population significantly without increasing the risk to public safety right now if we have better policies in place.
Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you'd like to talk about or like to leave us with?
Yes. The last two things I will say are two of the terms that I like to use are tools that I use regularly to reconnect and reweave the tapestry that I had destroyed. The tapestry of my relationship with my kids that I had destroyed by my actions was, one is meet them where they are. Meeting them where they are means you have to know what their developmental level is and where their interests are. Not what you hope they are, not what you think they should be. Over COVID, our kids were on lockdown for a very long time in the U.S. So that means they were home, not at school. And one of the ways my son passed his time was he played Xbox, as many teenage boys do. Trust me. If you don't know, trust me. And my son was addicted to a game called FIFA on Xbox. And FIFA is all the professional soccer leagues. And so I watched him play and learned about the players that he wanted to trade for and get on his team so he could compete. I was also an enlightened witness. That's the other term I like to use. I think a lot of parents try too hard. No, you don't have to be an instructor. Just be an enlightened witness to your child's life. And what that means is call them out when they're doing something, but cheer them on. Be their front row as well. So for my son, he was playing FIFA, and I was his front row. But I also learned all about the Premier League. I learned the difference between a penalty and offsides and a foul. I learned why you get a yellow card or a red card. I learned all the things about what we call soccer, right, and you guys call football, so that I could talk to him about it. And so I met him where he was, and then we're able to have a real conversation. I've been his enlightened witness. So then he can tell me what he's really doing, not just what he thinks I want to hear of what's going on. Those are the two terms that I would like to share and the way I've overcome the challenges I had with my kids. Be a good co-parent. And that means you never badmouth the other co-parent. I don't care if you think you have every reason to. Never, never, never. By badmouthing them, you're putting the kids in the middle of a fight they don't belong in. You're an adult, they're not. Respect that co-parenting relationship in every way you can, because you have to if you want to have a good relationship with your children, or you're putting it at risk. You're forcing those kids to choose, and they shouldn't have to do that. And to be a good parent, you need to meet your kids where they are and become an enlightened witness. I had to read all the Harry Potter books when I was in prison. And I know they're good books, and I know a lot of people love them. They're not my cup of tea, but my kids loved them. And I had to be able to meet my kids where they are. And to do that, I had to be able to talk about the examples that were in those books. Examples of kids who were orphans, for example, as my kids felt they were by me being away. Kids who were bullied, as my kids were, as my son wouldn't visit me for 18 months because of my crime. And those books had a lot of powerful, good examples, but I had to know those books or they wouldn't believe what I had to say. And so I met them where they were, and I used those examples. So those are the last couple things I'd like to say. And I take that very much to heart. And if anybody has learned anything and they're a parent or a co-parent, work on those two things. Be an enlightened witness, be the front row for your kids and cheer them on, and meet them where they are.
That's really good advice for being who we need to be for the people that we care about in general as well.
Well, and that's meeting them where they are and being an enlightened witness. Enlightened witness, not just a witness. If they're not doing well, you got to call them on that. But not to punish them, to help them learn what they needed to learn. Again, life happens for them, not to them. What did they have to learn from this? That's the way I look at it.
Wayne mentioned several resources during this conversation, and you'll find links to all of them in the show notes. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Is time served enough? And why is the stigma so great for the previously incarcerated? Let me know via the show notes.
Now, dear listener, it's your turn. Have you got something to add to the conversation? Then get in touch via the links in the show notes. Whether you have questions, a message of support, or resources that you think might help, we'd love to hear from you. And if by chance you know someone with a story that will inspire others, be sure to let us know. Your contributions help turn inspiration into action, drive positive change, and make life just that little bit better. And if this conversation inspired you to expand your worldview, head to hellohuman.global to join the conversation.